don't know about you, but my experience was of having a soundtrack to a perhaps an old movie going on in the back of my zazen. Those are the mental formations that were arising for me in the great space of emptiness. So tonight, I want to. I'm going to start by reading the first portion of the Heart Sutra as we chant. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, practicing deep Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five skandhas are empty, transforming all suffering and distress. Shariputra, form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness, no other than form. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness, exactly form. Sensation, perception, mental reaction, consciousness are also like this. Shariputra, all things are essentially empty. So, this is going to be the topic of this talk tonight. I'm going to be talking about emptiness, prajnaparamita, mental formations, the skandhas, which are listed here as sensation, perception, mental reaction, consciousness, and form. And I want to say that although these are kind of big and philosophical seeming concepts, this is not a incredibly arcane teaching. This stuff is what we are practicing and embodying in our zazen, and it is the functioning of the way we experience freedom in our life. So I know that the word emptiness, and especially these lines that form is emptiness, that these are, I think, maybe the maximally provocative language of Mahayana Buddhism, of the larger variety of Buddhism of which Zen is a part. So also is Pure Land Buddhism, Tantric Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism. I want to invite you to not be so certain that you don't understand what I'm talking about. So to begin, I want to talk about the experience of I'm going to be using a number of metaphors here. I'm going to different metaphors at different times. Metaphors all have limitations, and it's possible that you will rapidly see, or in discussion, will reach a point where what will happen is you have found the boundary of the place where the metaphor stops actually being useful, stops describing the larger experience. And yet, the metaphors are helpful. They're a kind of entree. They're a way in. And so in talking about emptiness and prajnaparamita, which is it's literally translated as the perfection of intuitive wisdom, or the wisdom that sees through. This is all related to kind of one side of the equation. It's related to what is sometimes called the absolute. It's sometimes called ultimate reality. It's sometimes called the world of emptiness. That's one side. The other side is conventional reality, the world of form, the relative. Now, one of the things Zen, unlike, for instance, some branches of Western philosophy, isn't about getting the right view. What it is also not about is replacing a preference or for the world of form, for conventional reality, with a preference for the world of emptiness, absolute reality. Zen, in myriad forms, and Zazen in myriad forms, is taking us also to the limits of the usefulness of an either-or mentality. It has to be either this or that, one or the other. And Zen is a kind of larger endeavor, kind of, and Zazen as a practice lets us experience a kind of both and. It's this way and it's this way. From one perspective it's this, from another perspective it's this. When we're here, it's useful to look in this way. Other times, it's useful to look in the other way. So the Heart Sutra, in talking about form and emptiness, is speaking to the absolute, although it's also talking about transforming all suffering into distress, which is the ultimate purpose of these things. And then on the other hand are, for instance, the precepts of right action, ceasing from harm, from evil, actualizing good for others. So these are concrete guidances for the world of form. And so, to begin with, I want to talk about rainbows. So consider the experience of a rainbow. What's involved? A rainbow is coming together of many causes and conditions, many things happening, arising codependently. So there is water or some kind of refracting medium in a kind of aerosolized form in the air spread out. There is a source of light coming through and hitting the water and refracting off of it. There is a being like ourselves positioned in such a way that the water in the air is between us and the light source, so it's illuminated from behind. And then when all of these things are just right, then we have the experience of seeing a rainbow. A rainbow is nothing other than this coming together of all of those causes and conditions, the water, the perspective, the viewing, the air, the light and the refracting. There is no continually existent rainbow. There is nothing that you can point to at any place that says this is the essence of a rainbow. You can't get a rainbow and put it in a jar. When a rainbow disappears because of causes and conditions, perhaps a cloud comes in front of the sun, or moisture ceases to be in the air, and then again reappears when the cloud passes away. Although we see that rainbow, and it may even be in the same relative place and looking the same, it isn't actually meaningful to talk about it as the same rainbow. It isn't the same rainbow from before. It's rainbow happening now. So, is everybody with me here on the rainbow image, right? And this doesn't mean that there's not a thing called a rainbow, right? We've all seen rainbows. We've all had the experience of a rainbow. So this dependence on causes and conditions, on factors arising, on things happening, this is called in Mahayana Buddhist language dependent origination. the arising of things in dependence on other things, or more specifically, the occurrence of events in dependence on other events. One Buddhist teacher, Andy Alinsky, says that in the Buddhist view, the fundamental kind of structure of the universe is events, not things. And this is part of what we're seeing with the language of dependent origination. And yet, rainbow is a noun. It is a thing, and we can think about a rainbow and come up with an image in our mind. But looking at the rainbow in terms of dependent origination is seeing it as arising because of causes and conditions, is seeing it as empty. There is no self-existent thing that is a rainbow aside from the causes and conditions that give rise to the experience of a rainbow. And that is an illustration of the emptiness of a rainbow. Don't be confused or misled by the connotations of the word emptiness. So in no way does it mean there's not a rainbow. In no way does it mean that the rainbow is meaningless. In no way does it mean that you somehow see the rainbow and at the same time see not the rainbow at the same time, whatever that would mean. I don't know what that would mean. It isn't about seeing through the rainbow as, instead of seeing the rainbow, as seeing it as light and water. And it isn't any kind of, Neo in the Matrix looking at something and seeing all of the little numbers, right? It's just the natural, normal, everyday experience of a rainbow is an experience of dependent origination, and that form of a rainbow is a expression of emptiness. It is empty. It is all causes and conditions. If you've read more than like one or two books on Buddhism, you may have encountered the term anatman, which is sometimes translated as either no self or non-self. And this is the same thing. So this is the same thing, but instead of talking about a rainbow, we're talking about a sense of self. So in the same way that we were talking about the experience of a rainbow, we're now talking about the sense of self. And the sense of self comes into being also because of causes and conditions. And the traditional way of listing the causes, the kinds of causes and conditions that go into giving rise to the sense of self is to list the skandhas. Skandhas is a Sanskrit word which means heap or aggregate, or it's also the word that refers to like the bark of a tree. So in the context, and the skandhas are, the Heart Sutra lists for us, form, sensation, perception, mental reaction, consciousness. Those are the five skandhas, the five aggregates. For our purposes, there's one that is related to form, and that's form. And then there's form, or one related to body and materiality, and then four that are related to stuff that we would classify as mental or internal experiences. That distinction is not really that important. And that division of sensation, perception, mental reaction, consciousness is just kind of the traditional Buddhist scriptural way of referring to all of the varieties of internal experience. So we could just say stuff that arises in your mind, stuff that arises, mental dharmas and physical dharmas, or even just, but even that distinction is in a way unnecessary, and we're just talking about the dharmas. Dharmas is a word which refers to the universe itself. Dharma with a capital letter and a singular refers to the teachings of the Buddha, but also the universe and reality as it is. And dharmas with an S and a lowercase letter in English just refers to stuff, things, phenomena. Anything that arises, anything that exists. So, in the same way that there are those causes and conditions that give rise to a rainbow, there are causes and conditions that give rise to a sense of self. This is an illustration of five kind of slightly overlapping circles forming a little kind of Rosetta fashion, and each of these is one of the aggregates. Form, consciousness, mental formations, perceptions, feelings, and the place where they overlap is labeled sense of self. So because of causes and conditions, sense of self arises, and then because of causes of condition and conditions, sense of self arises again in the next moment, and again in the next moment. And the teaching of no self is not that sense of self doesn't arise. It isn't that sense of self is wrong. It isn't that sense of self is an illusion or unreal any more than an experience of a rainbow is an illusion or unreal. It's a real experience of a rainbow. but this sense of self doesn't itself indicate the presence of something that definitely is the self that has a continued moment-to-moment existence, something that you can point to and go, this is me. Even though we have an experience of a sense of self arising in moments. So, but this is a explanation in a way of what we're doing in the Zazen of Shikantaza, for instance, or maybe it's even a description of why it is that Zazen or Shikantaza is a useful thing. So to get to there, I'm going to talk a little bit about this little piece of the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara, practicing deep prajnaparamita. So first of all, this the Heart Sutra is narrated there's a setup with Avalokiteshvara sitting there practicing prajnaparamita, and then Avalokiteshvara is speaking the rest of the Heart Sutra to Shariputra, who has just asked a question. Shariputra is a disciple of the Buddha. So first of all, this is the embodiment of compassion. Is the place where the Heart Sutra comes from to begin with. And practicing deep prajnaparamita, Now, leaving aside the word deep, because there isn't deep and shallow here, but practicing prajnaparamita is what we're doing every time when we get captivated by a thought, captivated by what's kind of arising in our mind, the experience of having, for me, a soundtrack to a black and white movie going on in the background of my zazen, getting captivated by that, and then recognizing that experience as just an experience, as a mental formation, as an expression of causes and conditions, as a skanda, an aggregate, a dharma, a thing arising in this moment. And when we recognize that as a arising thing, and not as a self-existent reality or truth in itself, and when we then see that that is merely a momentary and passing content of consciousness, but is not the whole of our consciousness, is not our essential selves, is not anything that is impermanent or unchanging. When we do that gesture of opening the hand of thought in our zazen, that is practicing prajnaparamita. When, for instance, a experience of anger comes up in us, and we notice that anger is present, and we recognize that that anger is composed of kind of like pulsing in our ears, of a sense of our mind spinning in this really compelling little ball, of a tightness in our chest, recognizing all of those composite parts of anger, and then not acting from that anger. That is practicing prajnaparamita. So, clearly saw that all five skandhas are empty. Form is empty, and all of the other mental formations, mental dharmas, are also empty, are also expressions, embodiments of emptiness. Now, we think that form is somehow a special case and we get hung up on it. It's not. And we think that because when we do this, our hand doesn't go through the floor, that somehow indicates that our hand and the floor is not empty. But this interaction is just what happens when the energy and causes and conditions that are this hand and the energies and causes and conditions that are this gesture encounter the causes and conditions that have given rise to the floor, and then there is the experience of these things coming into contact, and then my mind decodes that and processes that, and we call that solid. And solid doesn't refer to something other than that, but that thing that we call solid is just causes and conditions. And as such, even solidity is empty. But emptiness doesn't mean that I can put my hand through the floor, because I can't. So, clearly saw that all five skandhas are empty, transforming all suffering and distress. Now, this is really the heart of it. This is really important. This is the means by which zazen is useful. This is the means by which the skill we're practicing in zazen, the prajnaparamita we're practicing in zazen, this functions to free us from suffering, or in fact, seeing that all suffering and distress is just arising because of causes and conditions, and seeing that those things and the sense of self that we think is experiencing this suffering, seeing that those things are all causes and conditions, are all empty, even in the moment of experiencing distress, being free amid that distress, that's a description of what it is that this discipline yields. And it doesn't mean that there isn't suffering and there isn't distress. It doesn't mean that there isn't an experience of suffering and an experience of distress, and it doesn't mean that there isn't an experience of self in distress. But all of those things are just arisings. Shariputra, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Form is exactly emptiness, emptiness exactly form. Again, Shariputra. Just a little side note, I wish there were more punctuation in this, because with the Shariputra, here's where it's in quotation marks. This is Avalokiteshvara speaking and speaking to Shariputra. Shariputra, form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness, no other than form. So there is no embodiment, expression, occurrence, meaningful way to refer to anything, to any emptiness outside of in relation to form. It's only ever in relation to form. There isn't some other emptiness that is an emptiness like an ultimate emptiness or a great emptiness or some state we can get into that is emptiness. Just each form we are seeing is an expression of causes and conditions of dependent origination, dependent co-arising, and that reality, it means that form is emptiness. That's what that term means. So form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. So there aren't two worlds. Although we talk about the view from emptiness and the view from the relative, the view from form and the view from absolute, there's only one. Sometimes it's useful to look at it in one way. When we're in zazen, we are cultivating the skill of prajnaparamita, seeing mental phenomena arising as mental phenomena, seeing form arising as form. Other times, recognizing that they are just arisings, that they are emptiness, they are expressions of emptiness, and don't require that we do anything about it. So when we have the thought in zazen, "Oh my God, I have to get up and run screaming now," then we don't do that. So we're practicing, we're embodying, we're actualizing prajnaparamita because we have the impulse, "Oh my God, I need to run out of here this moment," right? But when we don't do that, we're seeing that as, okay, well, that's what my mind is doing right now. Other times, when, for instance, we're crossing the street and we see a car coming at us, then we elect to stay on the curb a moment longer till the car passes rather than stepping in front of it, that is recognizing it is acting appropriately in the world of form. We could practice seeing the emptiness and the dependent co-origination that give rise to the form that is the car and to the events and the causes and conditions that give rise to the velocity and then we could step in front of it and we could get killed by it. That yes, but don't do that. Form is exactly emptiness, emptiness exactly form. So this is the Heart Sutra being very emphatically clear here for us. Sensation, perception, mental reaction are also like this. Shariputra, all things are essentially empty. So now there is an experience that happens to many meditators and some non-meditators at some point in their practice where the mind gets very quiet and we have this experience of vastness or something, or we have an experience of no thoughts arising, or we have an experience of complete oneness and dissolution of self into whatever. All of those things, that is not any clearer a view of emptiness than a rainbow, than my thought about the soundtrack to an old movie, than a car. That's just another set of causes and conditions manifesting. And related to that, I wanted to read you this this part from a book called Mud and Water, The Collected Teachings of Zen Master Basri. Basri is a Japanese Zen teacher who lived two generations after Dogen in the 14th century. He's really great. He is ornery. And he's, you know, continually just, you know, busting out Manjushri's sword of wisdom and hacking away. And on the back cover of this book is a little quote from Basri. It says, "Today, students of the way go to teachers everywhere, but they don't penetrate all the way to the bottom of the great matter. They journey east, west, north, and south, and take pride in having met many teachers. They try to surpass others with Zen stories, and they collect paradoxical words and clever expressions from old masters. These are examples of the way of heretics." So here's Basri in 14th century Japan saying, "Kids these days, they don't know anything about Zen. They just read a few koans, they banter them around, and God, that's not it." A monk stepped forward and said, "I've already been able to meditate on emptiness." Basri responded, "Tell me how you meditate on emptiness." The monk said, "During meditation, I have complete control over scattered thoughts, and mind and body become one like a clear sky. At this time, I have no doubt that my body and mind are originally empty." Sounds great, huh? Basri replied, "That's not meditating on emptiness. That's merely the first view of emptiness aroused by all students of the way. If students arousing this point of view do not meet a good teacher, they will ignore the law of cause and effect and, like an arrow heading for its target, go directly to hell." The other thing about Basri is he is very fire and brimstone. So anytime he says hell, you can hear, suffering and the causes of suffering. He also clearly has issues with alcohol. He completely just, seems to, I think there's alcoholism that ran in his family. So he's talking around alcohol kind of, for me, ceases to have a kind of non-dual read for it, and it just seems like it's aversion. But that's not going on here. They will ignore the law of cause and effect, and like an arrow heading for its target, go directly to hell. In meditating on emptiness, you see clearly into your own nature. The five skandhas, form, feeling, thought, activity, and consciousness, are all empty. All delusions become extinct. Personal views are forgotten. The activity of making distinctions is exhausted, and the various demons have no place to perpetuate their acts. Even with the eyes of the Buddha, it cannot be seen, this world of peace and intimacy, this whole reality. It manifests as it is. So two things that I wanted to call to your attention. They will ignore the law of cause and effect, like an arrow heading for its target, go directly to hell. And ignoring the law of cause and effect is, on the one hand, the foolishness embodied by taking refuge in the absolute in the face of an oncoming call. And it is also the view of not of thinking that what you do doesn't matter, that the karma you create, that the way you use your body, mouth, and thought doesn't matter, that it doesn't have an effect on, that it doesn't create causes and conditions that then give rise to suffering or compassion, to suffering in the world or suffering for ourselves. That's ignoring cause and effect. And that's why the other side, if we were doing the longer liturgy tonight, we would have done the Heart Sutra and the recitation of the precepts. The precepts are a very clear presentation of wise action in the world of things. But even with the eyes of the Buddha, it cannot be seen. This world of peace and intimacy, this whole reality, it manifests as it is. So, this experience, any experience you have, is not it. It's just a experience that comes out of causes and conditions. And one other part. This is a really good book coming out this winter. It's called The Heart of the Universe, Exploring the Heart Sutra. It's really good. And I recommend it. Another way to understand shunyata, which is the Sanskrit word for emptiness, is through the Zen term now-ness, sometimes used interchangeably with momentariness. In the absence of a permanent abiding substance anywhere, there is only the now-ness of things, ephemeral, transitory, momentary. This now-ness is all there is. How things are is what they are. In traditional Buddhist literature, the now-ness of things is described as tathāgata, which is the first three quarters of tathāgata, and the tathāgata is the one of tathāgata, and is described as tathāgata, or suchness. The Mahayana elaboration of the notion of tathāgata suggested that when the futility of all conceptualized thinking is recognized, reality is experienced as pure suchness. What is realized in suchness is the existence of form as itself, but this realization is suffused with an intuitive wisdom, prajna, that sees form as momentary and essentially lacking shunya in any abiding essence. Masayo Abe, a 20th century teacher, among others, says that emptiness is suchness. I'm going to leave it there for now with the jabbering. Did anyone, and I want to invite engagement, comments, questions. My goal was to demystify this emptiness thing a little bit and make it more concretely present in your actual experience. But I'm also happy to take questions or complaints or reviews. Thank you. We will end with the four for this afternoon.